Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction. Today, I have with me from Jamaica, Marcia Douglas.
The way how I think of it is that the bass rhythm of the music of reggae has called them back, you know, for retrieval of the word and for the healing of the nation. The novel is dedicated to the healing of the nation.
We'll be talking about her 2016 novel, The Marvelous Equations of the Dread, a novel in bass rhythm.
I drew from reggae and used concepts such as version, remix, dub side, and used those as structural devices.
Marcia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jarrell.
I'm excited to talk about this one because it's not just a novel. You also bring in aspects of musicality into it as well. So looking forward to this. For those who haven't read it, talk to us about the novel. What happens in it?
Well, the novel is set in Halfway Tree in Kingston. And listeners who are familiar with Halfway Tree will know that there's a clock tower there in the square. And they would be familiar with the fact that Halfway Tree was once the site of a centuries-old cotton tree. So the Marvelous Equations imagines that a slave boy was hung from the tree in 1766 and that he died with a word at the tip of his tongue. And the novel, you might say, journeys to retrieve the word left at the tip of his tongue. And amid all of this, contemporary Halfway Tree becomes a site of return for many ancestors and historic figures, such as Bob Marley and Marcus Garvey and others. You might say, the way how I think of it is that the bass rhythm of the music of reggae has called them back. You know, for retrieval of the word and for the healing of the nation. The novel is dedicated to the healing of the nation.
So in terms of bass rhythm and in terms of dub music, like what did you hope to emphasize with this musical form as part of your writing style? Because I noticed as well some of the chapters, they begin with tracks. So talk to us about the music and how that made its way into the novel.
Yes, the novel is subtitled A Novel in Bass Rhythm. And I wrote it out of what you might call a reggae aesthetic. And in working with the music, I drew from reggae and used concepts such as version, remix, dub side, and used those as structural devices. So that's part of it, the structural devices of the novel. So that's why you'll see certain tracks and subsections, which might be a version and so on. For example, the dub side of the novel I think of as the spirit side. You know, when you listen to dub music, because it's instrumental, it has this sort of trance-like effect, you know. It has this power to almost take you into another zone. So that's why it feels like a dreamscape or a spiritscape, you might say. So in the world of this novel, it felt like the ideal space for the spirits to meet and convene. And for that reason, it's on the dub side that Bob Marley, for instance, meets with Haile Selassie, though they have both passed away. This is their space. This is their meeting place in the dub side. So that's part of how the devices work. I also work with the notion of version as well, because there are many stories within the story as well. And also I am returning to history, and I am, you know, looking at how the imagination comes to, how it comes to interact with history, fact and imagination, into a remix of sorts. In addition to all of the devices that I'm using, I also feel that there's something of reggae, which is a certain consciousness or worldview. And I'm working with that as well. And in addition, I'm working with something of the poetry of the baseline, and how, you know, something of the rhythms of reggae and the rhythm of bass, and how that comes to mold and shape language. It's a very acoustic novel, and I tried to write it with a keen ear. I listened to a lot of reggae while writing it.
Well, I mean, of course, I have to ask you, what's your favorite reggae song? And you can only choose one.
My favorite Bob Marley song or just reggae song?
Just reggae song. I'll talk to you about Bob Marley after.
Okay. Well, you know, I've been listening to a lot of Chronics lately.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know that I'm going to pick one song of his, but I'll just land on Chronics. And I love Janine as well.
You mentioned returning to history, and early on, very early on in the novel,
There
are you refer to Jamaica by its indigenous name. So let's talk about the indigenous influences as you saw it necessary to put that into this novel.
The novel begins with the consciousness of a Taíno woman. She is standing on the shore, looking out at the sea. You know, she sees those three ships on the horizon, and she sees what's coming, but she also looks past that, and she sees a contemporary Jamaica as well. You know, she says, "Listen, children, to what he cries," meaning this voice, this music, prophet who she sees on the horizon. I wanted to begin with that consciousness because, you know, Taíno, as the first people of Jamaica, need to be properly honored. You know, most Jamaicans have been educated to believe that the Taíno disappeared with the coming of the Spanish. However, a Taíno presence very much exists in the Caribbean and continues to persist. And part of the agenda of this novel is to journey back through history and, you know, and to reclaim history on our own terms. And that means reclaiming Taíno as well. I think of Taíno in a similar way to how I think of that silk cotton tree that used to be in Halfway Tree, and how the roots are underground and how the roots are very much alive, and how the cotton tree may not always be physically visible to us, but its presence is there, its spiritual presence. It's a reclaiming of history in various ways, and that necessarily includes the Taíno and the presence which still persists in the Caribbean and which hasn't been eradicated.
So now let's talk about Bob Marley, because very essential figure you mentioned him early on. We know about Bob Marley's music, but we might not know much about his personal life. So talk to us about using him returning to him in this novel, and what you felt about him was maybe underexplored or even unexplored.
Yeah. Well, Jamaica is much more than Bob, of course, but nonetheless, you know, Bob is definitely a part of our consciousness. You know, when Bob Marley passed away, you know, the streets were lined for miles and miles to, you know, to honor him and to watch his funeral motorcade. There was this great sense of loss, and you know, there was this heaviness which was in the air. So there's a way in which, you know, he represents a certain kind of creativity, I would say, which is innovative, but which also engages with spirituality and activism, those three things, and liberation consciousness. And so he set something of a high bar. And I don't know that anybody has necessarily filled his shoes. So I'm interested in what he represents. But beyond that, though, you know, as a writer, the interesting thing, what I love about being a writer, is that you also get to be something of a psychoanalyst as well. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's this way in which you can get to know your characters in an intimate way, not just fictional characters, but historical characters. So in this case, in dealing with a historical character, it took on other parameters as well. So, you know, as the writer analyst, you know, I took a really close look at Bob's psyche. And, you know, through my research, but also reading between the lines of that as well, you know, to see if I could excavate who he really is. One of the characters in the book, Lena, says something similar to that as well. You know, she says that, you know, on the surface, all you might see is the one love, but you have to peel away something of the layers. So it was my job then, in bringing him to the page as a character, to try to peel away the layers. And in peeling away the layers, you know, immersing myself in Bob, you might say, not just his music, but his history, every scrap of him that I could get, I caught a glimpse of his woundedness as well. And it occurred to me as a writer, you know, bringing his character to the page, that there's something of Bob which, you know, he was abandoned as a young boy by his biological father, Norval Marley. And there's something of his embrace of Haile Selassie as spiritual father, which was, in a sense, a way of, I want to say, compensating, but Haile Selassie became something of a healing substitute, you might say, for the real father, biological father, that Bob never had. And so that's one way in which I work with Bob as a character on the page. And maybe that's one part of Bob which is not often explored in that sort of way. The book, nonetheless, I want to say that, you know, it includes Bob as a character, but it's also about more than Bob as well. There's also Marcus Garvey and Maroon Nanny. And, you know, sometimes people think of it as a Bob book, but actually narrated by a woman, Lena, and her consciousness begins and ends the book. And a lot of what we get about Bob is actually seen via her lens. So it's as much her story as it is Bob's. And Lena allows us to, you know, peel away some of those layers of Bob that I'm talking about as well.
I feel that also something that you allow us to appreciate is Rastafarianism. So specifically, what you wanted to maybe illuminate about it, because at one point it says mysteries of the dub side, Rasta man without locks,
yeah,
and, lion without teeth. I think was the end of the sentence. So I'm sure a lot of people listening right now, we have certain images. It conjures up certain images, very specific images of what Rastafarian would look like. So talk to us about it, and what were you digging deeper into it?
Okay. So, you know, I'm interested in Rastafari in Jamaica because Rastafarians have always been at the forefront of Black consciousness and the struggle for equal rights in Jamaica. Mm. You know, Rastas were claiming Black consciousness before many others. You know, and so there's a way in which they've always been ahead of mainstream Jamaican society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so Rastas are trailblazers in that way. It's a community of trailblazers and free thinkers. And that's the aspect of Rastafari that I'm most interested in. I'm not interested in idealizing Rastafari in any kind of way, but I do mean to celebrate that kind of thought, and that kind of thought permeates the novel. You quoted the line something about what was it that you just said? Lion without teeth.
Yeah.
I believe that passage comes from the dub side, and it's thinking about Haile Selassie and Bob Marley there on the dub side. Mm-hmm. Haile Selassie is a good example of what I mean when I talk about trying to demystify Rastafari and take from it what is inspiring and great without idealizing it as well, because I do see Haile Selassie in that way. You know, he was an emperor of a nation, an African nation, that had never been colonized by European power. And he served as, you know, this great and important player in African world politics. And he came to be the symbol of Black consciousness. But having said that, I'm also interested in demystifying his character as well. And, picking at some of these images of him as this conquering lion, and looking at his flaws as well. So just like Bob Marley, I also took a really hard look at his character as well and took some liberties in my imagination. In this effort to celebrate his greatness, but also present him too as a man, as a human with frailties and with flaws. So that's what I'm doing with the characters, but also with the movement as well, you know, attempting to cast it in this light of complexity.
We should talk about, you mentioned as a writer, you're also a psychoanalyst, but you're also an academic. So let's talk about that side of you and how you brought that into this novel, particularly as it relates to style, but also thematically. Like, are you interested in these things apart from just your creative side? And how did it come together then?
Well, yeah. Well, I did a lot of research, certainly, in the effort to create this book. The book was almost 11 years in the making, so I did do a lot of research, and you know, I feel that my creativity is the way in which I theorize, you might say, and. Mm-hmm. So, on one hand, I would say that my role as an academic enabled the creation of the book, and fed into, you know, something of its research. But there's also another way in which it was separate. And what I mean by this is that you don't get to revel in the sort of spiritual and soulful discourse in quite that way in academia. But you can do it as a fiction writer on the page, and that's the way in which I would say that it was separate from my role as an academic. Does that make sense?
We haven't. Let's talk about the sort of speculative elements in the novel. We've talked about these historical figures. Let's also talk about these references to such things as duppies. There's a fallen angel. So talk to us about how this work, even though it's for the most part taking place in the past, it can help us understand the present and even the future.
There's a line somewhere in the book which I use, which is, if the stones do not cry out, then the dead will. And so in this book, you know, it is a book which takes a look at history and sufferation, oppression, and also this sense of... difficulty in emerging out of all of that, and in sometimes moving forward. In the effort to break all of that apart and come up with solutions, the novel looks to the dead, looks to the spirit world. There's a moment in the book where the dead convene, where Bob Marley convenes with Queen Nanny and Marcus Garvey and various other characters from the spirit world as well. They convene because the music has called them back, but also because there is this urgency. And what they decide is that we need to put our efforts into nurturing the youth. And this is part of the message which the dead bring to us, and also, I hope, part of the message of the novel and a key to moving forward and healing the nation, to nurture the youth and for the youth to come forth. So that's one way in which I'm using the spirit world. They, you know, the spirit world comes to be messengers and healers. These voices and guides, which mean to support and lift us up, even though they themselves have frailties as well.
You mentioned the spirit world, and I want to ask if there's anything else you can say about that with relation to one line in particular. It referenced the astrology of the dead. And you know, anything you want to add about that? Because I can gloss over that line with my science fiction cap on. Talk to us about the astrology as you saw it playing.
Well, I had fun with that turn of phrase, the astrology of the dead, you know, and mulling through that and what it means.
Yeah.
I think that's actually a line which is used at the moment that Norval and Bob meet in the clock tower. And you know, I thought to myself that, you know, well, you know, in the world of this novel, one's time of death is just as important as one's time of birth. Which is to say that the circumstances of one's death might have some sort of influence over one's afterlife or everlife. So not just referring to, you know, movement of sun and moon and planets, but the overall circumstances of one's passing as well. So I became intrigued with this notion of, you know, how the dead operate via astrology, you know, and this notion that death is sort of this entry into this alive portal, you know, and that the dead have some sort of agency as well. So that's where this whole notion of astrology comes from.
Marcia, we're near the end. We're pretty much at the end of the chat. We talked about the dub side. We talked about bass rhythm and reggae. And you know, I feel we should do something. We should, you know, you mentioned your favorite reggae artist.
You know, I mentioned Chronix earlier. You know, and one song of his which comes to mind is "Here Comes Trouble." And I love that song because, you know, there is this moment towards the end of the book where the youth are coming up and, you know, they're coming down into Kingston and they're moving towards the clock tower. And, you know, with all of their instruments and vigor and voice and sound and activism. And at the time that I was writing that passage, you know, I didn't know Chronix's song. I didn't even know if he had made that song yet. But upon hearing it, I thought to myself that it could be something of a soundtrack for that moment. So that's what's playing in my head right now. Here Comes Trouble, you know, but in the most positive way.
So with that, I still want to give you one more chance. Anything else you want to leave us with?
I would like to end on the note of the healing of the nations, you know, and what I was emphasizing earlier about this call to take care of our youth. A nation is only as good as its youth. And I think I would like to end on that note, that we need to take care of our young ones and support them. You know, they're you know, every time you listen to the news in Jamaica, there's some young girl who has gone missing, you know, and children are subject to so much abuse and violence. There's also you know, more that can be done for the LGBTQ community in Jamaica as well. The youth in that community undergo a lot of hardship. So I would like to put out a call for us to embrace and take care of our youth, because you know, they are the future of all of us moving forward, continuing to move forward in a powerful and healthy way.
So Marcia, I want to thank you again so much for doing this.
Thank you. Plenty of thanks.
And to everyone listening, thank you as well. Continue to stay tuned to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.